Marty Moss Cohen, welcome to Radio Times. Yesterday, thousands of people attended a public memorial service for Penn State football coach Joe Paterno, who died on Sunday of lung cancer. Among the speakers was Nike chairman Phil Knight, who criticized the university trustees and said, "There is a villain in this tragedy. It lies in that investigation, not in Joe Paterno's response." He got a standing ovation. Knight was referring to a grand jury report that accused Paterno's former assistant coach Jerry Sandusky of multiple counts of child sex abuse. The trustees fired Paterno last fall for failing to do more when he heard about an alleged assault involving Sandusky and a young boy. Joe Paterno was a beloved and winning coach who stressed academics along with athletics. Today on Radio Times, how should he be remembered, and what does this saga say about the status of college sports figures? We have two guests who have joined us. Dave Zirin is sports editor for The Nation magazine, host of the SiriusXM weekly show Edge of Sports Radio. He's a columnist for Slam magazine and the progressive author of several books, including The John Carlos Story and Bad Sports. Dave Zirin, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Hey, great to be here. Thank you.
You're very welcome. Also with us is Sally Jenkins. She's a sports columnist for The Washington Post. She's also written for Sports Illustrated, author of The Real All-Americans and The State of Jones. And she interviewed Joe Paterno shortly before he died. And Sally Jenkins, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Sally, let me begin with you and actually begin with your interview with Joe Paterno about a week before he died. Did Joe Paterno think that he should have done more when he heard of this alleged child rape?
He did. He said exactly that. He said, "I should have asked, where are we with this?" He believed he did the appropriate thing in passing it to his superiors, Tim Curley and particularly Gary Schultz. But he then didn't follow up, and he regretted not following up. He said he should have asked more questions, but he said he was very reluctant to do that because he didn't want to be seen as interfering in the procedure one way or the other, whether for or against Jerry Sandusky. And also, he was simply very uncomfortable with the subject matter, both of which, I have to say, I found pretty plausible. I think that one thing that's gotten lost in all of this is that Joe Paterno is actually one of the few people who did anything at all.
Because he went to the university officials to tell what he was told.
Yes. I mean, he did, if nothing else, he did set up a meeting between Mike McQuarrie and his superiors and made sure that Mike McQuarrie was interviewed by his superiors at the university.
Was he bitter from your interview about the way the university treated him?
He was not. I take that back. He admitted to being actually extremely angry initially, once he was fired by phone call that night when the Board of Trustees basically fired him with a phone call. He spent a couple of days being very angry, and then he said, we've got to get on a higher plane here, and he did his level best not to be angry, to understand that he had 61 good years, which is more than most universities give head coaches, and really actually spent the last days of his life trying to make his family less angry.
Oh, interesting, and I want to pick up on that, but Dave, let me turn to you. Should we judge Joe Paterno by something that he didn't do in 2002?
I think you always have to judge people by the totality of their lives. I mean, what gives us the right to judge any public figure is perhaps a topic for a different discussion. But once somebody is in the public eye, their life, especially when they mean so much to a community and become a subject of so much idolatry, it becomes then a very real question about the kind of lessons we hope to pass on. And if there is a teachable moment here from Joe Paterno's life, it is about the seriousness with which we need to take allegations when they involve the possibility that small children are being harmed. I certainly agree with Sally, and I agree with Phil Knight about the fact that Joe Paterno was the person who actually did what was legally expected of him in this situation. But at the same time, the very myth of Joe Paterno, the very ethos of Joe Paterno, the way he was built up in all of our minds, and frankly built up in a way that he never objected to, I mean, it's his name on the library, it's his statue on campus, led us all to believe and projected upon all us the idea that he would do more than he did, that seeing Jerry Sandusky walking around his campus or being on the sideline at a bowl game with a child would be the sort of thing that would send the Joe Paterno we thought we knew into, if not a rage at the very least, into the offices of campus police and saying, what the hell is going on here? I reported this years ago.
Well, and just picking up on what you actually wrote about this, Dave, which is that he did the minimum of what was required, but because he was Joe Paterno, we expect more than that? Is that what you're saying? We expected
yeah,
more than that?
Yeah, and I think that I'm happy to say that that could be on us, too, and
sure.
how we idolize people in the world of sports and perhaps project upon them ideals and character that maybe in reality they do not possess. So I think we should take some of the weight as far as what our expectations are of what he should have done. Mm-hmm. But that doesn't change the fact that when we look at this, I think all of us think, whether this is true or not, but I think all of us think instinctually that we would have done more.
Well, let me go back to you, Sally, and I do want to talk about it more than just this particular incident, but of course this incident is so important. It's one of the reasons that Joe Paterno got fired. But as you write, and as he said to you, he didn't want to, in a sense, throw his weight around or use his influence. But it seems to me he was Joe Paterno. I mean, he had clout on that campus. He could have done more.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I don't think he would have disputed that with you. He would have. He objected to the characterization of himself as sort of the all-knowing, all-seeing, all-powerful figure on campus. The idea that he had more power than even the university president or the trustees. He objected to that characterization, but he certainly understood that he had muscle and clout, and that's exactly why he said, "I probably should have done more." What he did say was that it was a very difficult situation to know how to handle. It was not anything in 60 years or rather 58 years or whatever it was in 2002. He had dealt with a lot of problems on the Penn State campus, but child sexual abuse and an allegation of something improper sexually with a child was nothing he'd ever encountered. And he basically portrayed himself as being very unclear as to what the appropriate procedure was. Mm-hmm. And it's funny. I think that we all, as Dave just said, we all like to think we know exactly what we would have done. But there are very tricky human resource questions. There are very tricky questions regarding privacy in these sorts of very damning allegations. I'm not sure it really was so simple and so clear-cut, and I'm not so sure that all of the people who have been raving about what should have been done, I really have serious questions as to what a lot of these people would have done in Joe Paterno's shoes, and I think it's very easy to sit around and say, oh, it was terribly clear-cut. Put yourself in a situation where someone that you have thought you knew very well for 30 years is accused of harming a child. Put yourself in the position of having to imagine that this person who had a reputation for actually being wonderful with children and very good for children, try to embrace that idea that you get a report that is the dead opposite of who this person appeared to be, and then couple that with, very complicated questions of university procedures, legal procedures, and whether you yourself would have really been so very clear as to what to do with this allegation, particularly when the allegation, it now appears from grand jury testimony and the preliminary hearing, was not actually nearly as clear-cut as we initially thought it was from press reports. Mike McQuarrie was indeed vague with Joe Paterno. All he told him was that something inappropriate of a sexual nature appeared to have happened in that locker room.
Dave, let me go back to you, and I appreciate what both you and Sally were saying, and again, it's trying to understand the totality of someone's life when looking at it through this particular incident and what did and didn't happen as a result of that incident. But everything I read about Joe Paterno, he was so passionate about his players, so involved in their personal lives, and such a forceful presence in their lives. So there's a kind of a weird disconnect when you hear about young boys who are allegedly being abused, even if it's by someone that you think you know.
Well, it's interesting because one of the bizarre side effects of this scandal at the end has turned into this discussion with this very, very big dichotomy of saying 6 decades of greatness, a couple of months where we're all judging him for a decision he made 12 years ago or 10 years ago that maybe was not even all that clear-cut in the first place. And I think if the scandal of the last couple of months hadn't happened, I still think it would be complicated in terms of how we were talking about Joe Paterno. I mean, this was somebody who, there was a big story, I believe it was in Sports Illustrated, about the number of players who had run afoul of the law over the last several years. And there have also been stories that have come out about him saying that his own players should not be subject to the same campus code of conduct as the rest of the school itself, that they should be playing by their own rules. And then in 2006, there was this, you know, moment where he spoke in a very inopportune fashion about a player for Florida State who'd been accused of rape. And if you go back and look at the statement from the National Organization for Women in Pennsylvania, it's really rather harrowing to read it. Like, it's a statement where they say, if you are taking such a lax approach to accusations of sexual assault, it's very frightening to think about what might be ignored if this is your attitude towards things. And the National Organization for Women, at that point, they asked for his resignation, but then they asked if there could be some kind of a meeting of the minds so they could discuss sexual abuse. I mean, they were talking about strictly in terms of campus male-on-female rape, which, of course, is very different from what happened with Sandusky. But there was no response from Penn State at any level to the National Organization for Women, let alone from Paterno, about saying, can we please have a serious conversation about this? And you can. And these are very real questions, and they're not just Penn State questions.
Right.
They're questions about the privileging of college athletes in the context of them making no money for bringing in millions of dollars of revenue, and yet having to create some form of, I guess you'd call it, a gutter economy to make sure that they would be attracted and loyal to your campus. I mean, these are very real questions that speak to every major college football program. And their questions now that become lost in a very easy dichotomy of six decades of greatness, one bad choice where he might have done the right thing, and maybe we should just back off.
I mean, Dave, it sounds like you're talking about the Joe Paterno who was put on a pedestal, not just at Penn State University, but in Pennsylvania.
Well, or nationally.
National
politics. This was a person who dined with presidents, and for good reason, too. I mean, you can give him all the credit in the world for building up an entire region of the state, or at the very least creating a brand that allowed Penn State to become the kind of multi-billion dollar endowment, profoundly successful research institution that's become. I was reading an article this morning in preparation for this. I mean, Penn State's research departments are second to none nationally, even internationally, but a lot of the seed money for those very institutions on campus came when Penn State joined the Big Ten, and how important that was as football to bring in that extra money to create the seed money for those research institutions. So you can't separate football from the greatness that is Penn State, and it is one of the great state schools, of course.
Well, let's take a very short break. We'll get back to our conversation. Much to talk about. We are talking about how to remember Joe Paterno. He died on Sunday. He was buried this week. Dave Zirin, sports editor of The Nation magazine, host of the SiriusXM weekly show called Edge of Sports Radio. Also with us is Sally Jenkins. She's sports columnist for The Washington Post. In fact, interviewed Joe Paterno shortly before he died. We are opening up the lines for your phone calls, and we're interested in how you will remember Joe Paterno and how you understand his legacy. Give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Stay with us. Call us. We'll be right back.
The Philadelphia Orchestra supports WHYY. A Philadelphia Orchestra showpiece, Rimsky-Korsakov's spectacular Scheherazade, under guest conductor Nicola Luisotti, plus Shostakovich's first violin concerto with Nadia Salerno-Sonnenberg. For your tickets, 215-893-1999, online at philorc.org. February 2nd, 3rd, and 4th at the Kimmel Center, Scheherazade, with the Philadelphia Orchestra.
Hello, I'm Christine Dempsey.
And I'm Ed Cunningham.
If you tune to WHYY more than 4 hours a week, then you're a loyal listener.
And since you are, you might be interested in our YStream service.
YStream is a thank you gift that gives you online access to programs without pledge breaks.
Make your donation to WHYY before Monday, and you can listen pledge-free on your iPad, iPhone, PC, or Mac.
Visit whyy.org/YStream for details.
Did you say I've got a lot to learn?
On the next Fresh Air, we remember Etta James. She died last week at the age of 73. And we'll listen to our 2009 interview with Woody Allen. His film Midnight in Paris has been nominated for a Best Picture Oscar. Join us.
this afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowen talking with Sally Jenkins and Dave Zirin about how to remember Joe Paterno, who died on Sunday. He was buried this week. There were memorial services and tributes and outpourings of grief. In fact, in Pennsylvania, the state flags were hung at half-mast in honor of his career at Penn State University. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Sally, I'd like to go back to the article that you wrote about Joe Paterno, and you say Paterno's portrait of himself is an old world man profoundly confused by what McQueary, and he was the man that came in and told him about what he had observed with Jerry Sandusky and this young boy, and he says, I didn't know which way to go, and he wasn't sure exactly what to do. Then he goes on to say that he had never heard of rape and a man. What does that tell you?
That was the most provocative quote from the interview, and you go one of two ways with that. You either believe that Joe Paterno, who was born in 1926 and is a man of a certain generation, really had no vocabulary for discussing, child rape, homosexual rape, or you go, no one's that naive, and he was a member of the Catholic Church that was racked by these scandals, and that he's overstating his naivete there. I actually interpreted. I mean, he was genuinely distressed when he said it. You know, I still don't know quite what to make of the remark, and wish I had maybe followed that one up a little bit better. Mm-hmm. But I one thing I can tell you is that the way I interpreted it at the time was that Paterno wasn't necessarily saying he'd never heard of male on male rape. But what he really meant, and I'm not really here to be his interpreter, I can only tell you what my impression was from the conversation, but what he meant was that it was nothing he had ever dwelt on, nothing he could articulate very well, nothing he wanted to know more about, and that what he was trying to say was, this just wasn't anything that I felt capable of really dealing with, mentally, intellectually, socially, legally, etc.
Dave, and even just picking up on that, I mean, Joe Paterno is not alone in this, whether we're talking about, the sex abuse scandal with the Catholic Church, other sex abuse scandals involving children, the Boy Scouts, this sort of level of denial, obviously dangerous, but so deep in many ways.
Yeah, and I mean, I think you can't ignore the way there's a part of it that I think is rooted in homophobia and rooted in a kind of instinctual revulsion in part of the heterosexual community about the prospect that this kind of thing could even happen. But I think what you describe is why the laws in many states are changing about this. Like, if Joe Paterno had, and this is just so people know what I mean here, if Joe Paterno had done exactly what he did, and Mike McQueary had done exactly what he did, and Mike McQueary's father, in telling Mike McQueary to go to Joe Paterno first, had done exactly what they did, but they'd done it one state over in Delaware instead of in Pennsylvania, they would have been subject to criminal charges.
Because
in Delaware, the laws are very clear that you actually need to go to an actual police officer. It can't be the subject of a campus investigation or sent to campus police. And I think the laws are changing state to state precisely so that there is a standard, and hopefully that this will have people understand that there is a standard here that says if you hear about this, you go to the police, let them handle it. Hopefully the privacy issues, which Sally raises, I think are critical, false accusations, those are also very critical things to keep into account. But the first and foremost issue is, are there children in danger? How do we protect them? Go to the police.
Sally, let me go back to you, and even as both you and Dave are talking, I'm thinking about how someone like Joe Paterno and other sports figures, they get put on these enormous pedestals, and we seem to have a kind of either-or approach to sports figures. You know, either they're the greatest thing that has ever come down, or they get knocked down because they are imperfect. Is this part of you think, the struggle of how we think about sports people and how we should think about Joe Paterno's legacy?
Oh, absolutely. I think we lose all the shading and all the nuance and any sense that someone in Joe Paterno's position can be fallible and they'll make a decision or make a judgment that's less than perfect. I will say, let me go back to one thing Dave just said. Mike McCreary testified in the preliminary hearing that when he went to Gary Schultz, when Joe Paterno set up the meeting with him and Gary Schultz, both he and Paterno thought they were going to the police. Gary Schultz was the officer at the university who presided over the campus police department. I think one of the things that this speaks to, you know, we can discuss national laws, but one of the things that it seems to me that happened in this Penn State case is it was a classic case of town and gown. The campus police department, you know, and the state college, you know, environment. What happens when the chief police officer or the man who presides over the campus police department is a guy like Gary Schultz, who's also charged with protecting the interests of the university? Mm. I mean, that was just a clear conflict, and that was one of the things that made it so difficult, I think, for Penn State officials to sort out what to do. Secondly, let me go back to something else, just because, in all fairness, I think this needs to be clarified. The incident that Dave talked about with Joe Paterno at the bowl game a few years ago and the accusation of sexual assault, first of all, no charges were ever brought. That player was actually, as I recall, never charged. Second of all, Joe Paterno was close friends with Bobby Bowden, the head coach of Florida State, and I think that Joe Paterno probably had a pretty good idea that it was a false accusation, or at least an accusation that they were not going to be able to bring any charges against. So you have to go back and look at that incident, recognizing those two facts. What Paterno said at the time was not especially intelligent or tasteful, but I also don't think it rises to the level of making him insensitive to sexual assault or insensitive somehow to child rape. So I just wanted to, you know, factually, I think we have to be a little bit careful with that one.
And Dave, I actually want to quote something that you wrote, edgeofsports.com, and you said, "Let Paterno's last teachable moment be this. If your football coach is the highest paid and most revered person on your campus, you have a problem. If your school wins multiple championships and a booster drops money to build a statue of the coach, tear it the hell down. And if you don't, and if you think children are being raped, the minimum just isn't good enough, no matter whether or not you wear a crown." Is that sort of summarize where you stand today?
Absolutely. It's where I stand. I mean, W.E.B. Du Bois was talking about this a century ago, about the fear of what happened to what would happen to a college if King football, as he described it, stands astride the entire campus, economically, culturally, morally, if it stands astride the whole campus. What it does is it distorts, I mean, some of the original ideas of what campus sports were supposed to be. I mean, I know that genie is so out of the bottle at this point after decades and decades and decades of college football becoming a de facto minor league for the National Football League. But even in the last 30 or so years, it's just gotten so ridiculous. I mean, Woody Hayes, the Hall of Fame coach, another person whose legacy was marred by something that happened at the very end of his career, hitting an opposing player on the field. But Woody Hayes, at the of Ohio State, at the peak of his powers, made $42,000 a year. $42,000 a year. They just signed Urban Meyer to be the new coach at Ohio State for a base salary of $4 million a year. Now, if nothing else, this speaks to a question of priorities and of what, I mean, we talked about Phil Knight before, the CEO of Nike, and who spoke in very combative terms at Joe Paterno's funeral, public funeral. And, I mean, when you go to the University of Oregon campus and you see this huge state school where secretaries are being furloughed, classes are being cut, professors are being furloughed, whole departments are being reorganized, and at the same time, you have these new facilities completely funded by Nike for the athletes themselves, brand new buildings that look nice as anything that Donald Trump has ever built, where professors aren't even allowed above the first floor, so the next two floors can be dedicated to, quote-unquote, student study. When you have underwater treadmills, for goodness sakes, I don't even want to venture what each one of those costs per unit. I mean, it creates a sense of priorities on a campus, which I think distorts very fundamentally academic missions and creates the very kind of town-and-gown dynamic that Sally described. And I think what scares us so much about Penn State is you see it, what it showed for all of us is how evil it can get when college football plays by its own rules and when there's a desire to protect that world. It's one thing when you have Ohio State and it's like, oh, players are trading their jerseys for tattoos, or Miami even, where it's like, oh, they get strippers for the players. Because at the very least, you look at that and say, that's corrupt, that's ugly, but isn't at the end of the day, isn't it victimless? Like, you can sort of skate back a little bit on it. But when you look at Penn State, it's just like, wow. So this is how deep it could possibly go when there's no real controlling authority on a football program.
And let me get some callers in the conversation. We are talking about how to remember Joe Paterno, Penn State University football coach who died on Sunday. And what does this sad saga say about the status of college sports figures? Dave Zirin, sports editor of The Nation magazine, Sally Jenkins, sports columnist for The Washington Post. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHY. Why? Let me get Mary from Allentown to join our conversation. Mary, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. I was at the memorial service yesterday in Bryce, Jordan. I am not a Penn State alumni. I am a person who, through brothers and sisters and all, recognized the vision of Joe Paterno, dignity, success with dignity. If you were in that room yesterday, there was a palpable love for Mr. Paterno, for Coach Paterno, for Father Paterno, how he treated his boys, all of the football players that have thousands that have played for him over the years. He did what he had to do, and he is not the demon in the room, as the CEO of Nike said. There is one. They'll find it sooner or later. But Coach Paterno, to the best of a human being's ability, always did the right thing, always tried to keep education first and foremost in his players, and I will respect him. I respect him now. I will respect him in the future. They hate mongerers. They're, I just guess, jealous. But if you were in that room and you heard the players speak from each decade, if you heard the other speakers they had, and then finally Jay, we all know that for 84 years and 3 months, Joe had the best life he could possibly have had. He had 3 months of hell, but he always had his family. And as Jay said, he went in peace.
Well, Mary, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Let me give Sally Jenkins a chance to respond. And by all accounts, it was a very emotional public ceremony yesterday. Obviously, people like Mary who love Joe Paterno, and she says he always did the right thing.
Well, he, in one sense, did do the right thing, but did he do the maximum that the law allowed? He did the minimum that the law required. Did he do the maximum that the law allowed? No. I think one thing we may have to brace ourselves for the possibility of is that we may never finger the personal demon in this case. It may very well turn out to be, and there are no fewer than 5 investigations looking into this now, that there was no arch villain. If Jerry Sandusky is indeed guilty, he is the arch villain. If there is another arch villain, I'll be surprised. I suspect what may come out of all these investigations is not necessarily a deep, dark, cover-up on the level of Watergate, but maybe a very large institution with very ill-defined procedures and systems for dealing with something like this, and a number of people who simply didn't know what they were looking at when they looked at Jerry Sandusky. I think we can't forget that Jerry Sandusky passed several muster sessions with Child State Services. He adopted children. He was a foster parent. Nobody in that system seemed to recognize that there was a potential problem here either. There are hundreds of people in the state of Pennsylvania who, if Jerry Sandusky is guilty, missed something critical. Mm. So I'm not at all sure that all of this vitriol and determination to find someone, some guilty party apart from Jerry Sandusky, is actually going to, in the end, be very enlightening. I think what would maybe be more helpful, and I could be wrong, I mean, there may be further revelations that show that there was a cover-up. We can't be certain yet. We have to let all that play out. But I think that the most critical thing is to really figure out how these acquaintance child molesters are able to so deeply embed themselves in communities. And one of the things that FBI profiler Ken Lanning, who has studied these sorts of child molesters for 30 years, one of the things that he told me in an interview not too long ago was, these people are just as good at seducing adults as they are children. One of the things that happened here, if Sandusky is guilty, is that he absolutely convinced all of the adults around him that he was great with kids and great for kids.
Well, you know what? And we've done several shows about all of that. And Sally, I appreciate those comments. And I'm sure you've got something to add, Dave. But let me get back to our callers. And it looks like we have Anthony from Philadelphia joining us on Radio Times. Anthony, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. I've only recently moved to Philadelphia, and so I'm not from Pennsylvania. And I'm not Italian American. I grew up in an Italian American family that very much identifies that way. And for that reason, I knew, you know, growing up who Joe Paterno was. You know, but at the same time, being here and watching all of this unfold and the coverage of it and how kind of unhinged, I have to say, much of it has been. The recent alumni meetings that have happened with college officials that you guys have covered, the newspapers have covered. There was one in King of Prussia recently. I mean, those people, the alumni, I mean, they come across, I have to say, as crazy.
Well, you know what, Anthony, let me take your call only because I'm looking at our clock here and I want to give Dave Zirin a chance to weigh in. And to some degree, we were debating about how to do this show today, and I was on the fence. I didn't know how to talk about this, and you don't want to sort of feed into vapid coverage. But nonetheless, there are issues here to discuss. But Dave, are you surprised,
yeah,
as Anthony is, about just the level of coverage
over
the week?
Anthony was saying something at the end there that I think is very important to identify, and it's one of the things that's, I think, been very disturbing to me in this whole process, and that's this real disconnect that does exist between a Penn State community and family. And I certainly don't want to overgeneralize. I mean, there have been tremendous vigils on campus on behalf of child abuse victims. There's been a lot that's gone on there, and yet that those very alumni meetings, which I haven't attended any. I've read transcripts of them, read reports of them. But, like, the descriptions that people's anger from the people who are showing up to these town hall meetings with the new school president, that the anger is based around how Joe Paterno was treated. And it's like, where are the statements of anger about, was there, in fact, an institutional cover-up of child rape? I mean, if that was my school, I don't know, you know, that would be horrifying. And the night that there was the sort of low-frequency lowercase r riot on campus, when there was efforts to overturn an ESPN truck and set fires, when Joe Paterno was fired with that awful 10 p.m. phone call, I'll never forget, my mother called me, and I said, Mom, I can't talk. Penn State students might be rioting. I need to be up on this. And my mom said to me, well, it's good they're rioting. I'm glad they're that angry about what happened to those kids.
Oh, interesting. Well, Dave, hold on to that thought because we have to take a very short break, and we'll get back to our callers and our conversation. We are talking about how to remember Joe Paterno, the legacy, the complicated legacy of Joe Paterno. Dave Zirin, sports editor of The Nation magazine. Sally Jenkins, sports columnist for The Washington Post. One open line at 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. Call us. We'll be right back.
The Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts supports WHYY. On view January 28th through April 15th, Henry Ossawa Tanner, Modern Spirit, an exhibition featuring more than 100 works by the legendary African-American artist, including paintings shown in the U.S. for the first time. Modern Spirit revisits Tanner's extraordinary career as a critically acclaimed artist in the United States and France at the turn of the 20th century. For details, 215-972-7600 or PAFA.org.
This November, one of the biggest prizes in the presidential race will be Florida's 29 electoral votes. But the state is already a battleground as the Republican candidates fight for the chance to take on President Obama in the fall. I'm Robert Siegel. Primary voters in Florida head to the polls on Tuesday, and NPR News will bring you results, reaction, and analysis. Live coverage of the Florida primary from NPR News.
Tuesday night at 8 on WHYY.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. What's going on in Libya? Reports of pro-Gaddafi loyalists taking back towns. We'll get a report from Tripoli. Also, the Facebook timeline, kind of a file cabinet for everything you've ever put on Facebook, whether you like it or not. That's Public Radio's daily digest of news and culture, here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss Cohen. We are talking about college sports, the status of college sports figures, and how to remember Joe Paterno, who died on Sunday, was buried on Wednesday. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Let me get Carol from Malvern to join us. Carol, go ahead. You're on Radio Times. Do we not have Carol? Well, I wanted to get Carol on just because we're looking for a mix of calls. And perhaps, Sally, I can put this to you. We heard from Mary from Allentown, and she talked about she was there at the memorial service yesterday and obviously feels very strongly about Joe Paterno. And she talked about the hate mongers. And Carol from Malvern, and I'm sorry we can't get her on, is Catholic and believes that he dropped the ball. I mean, as Dave was talking about, we see this disconnect, a real division over Joe Paterno and what did or didn't happen. Do you want to weigh in on that?
Sure. I mean, I think the entire situation is marked by, these sort of excesses of feeling. First of all, the crime itself is rage-making. I mean, I actually understand a lot of the response to it because, you know, it is incensing the notion that inattention or insensitivity or blind spot or cover-up could have sacrificed children. That's just crazy making. And so, I understand the registers of feeling on that side. On the other side, there are really profligate excesses of feeling around college football, as Dave has so brilliantly described today. I mean, he's absolutely right. I agree with him 100%. One of the things that's going on here is, you know, a certain sense of self and self-respect that was developed by Penn State football in the state college community is under attack, and people feel terribly threatened. A lot of people attach their self-esteem and a certain sense of superiority to Penn State football. One of the things that Graham Spanier, the president of the university, did, and Joe Paterno himself did, as Dave described earlier, is basically declare to the world, hey, we do things better here. Mm-hmm. And they made no bones about it. They traded on it and profited on that reputation for many, many years.
Let me get, looks like Jennifer from Valley Forge to join our conversation. And Jennifer, go ahead, you're on Radio Times.
Hi there. I completely agree with Sally that I went to Penn State in the late 80s, and I was drinking the Kool-Aid more than I really thought I was. When this happened, I was devastated. But I and a number of my friends from Penn State do not feel the same way that the caller from Allentown does in terms of, I mean, and one of my friends said she put all of her Penn State paraphernalia away. Her kids will not be attending Penn State. I feel a similar way. I certainly don't blame Joe Paterno for the whole thing. I mean, I think it's more of an institutional thing, like Dave was saying. And I was just shocked by those town hall meetings. I mean, I live near the King of Prussia one, and I couldn't believe when I saw on the news that people, you know, their main issue was why was Joe Paterno fired instead of saying, you know, what is wrong with the school? Mm-hmm. What happened? I mean, I don't think I can ever feel the same way about the school again. Well, and it's devastating. Part of who I am, you know?
Yeah, no, I appreciate that. Well, yeah, actually, Dave, let me give Dave a chance, and then Sally, I'll give you a chance as well. Go ahead, Dave.
Very briefly, one of the few, I never thought I'd say this, but one of the few sane voices I feel like over the last couple of months where I just sort of said thank you out loud while looking at my computer was a head football coach, was Bo Pelini from Nebraska. Remember, Penn State played Nebraska just days after Joe Paterno was fired. And you know, there was all this ceremony at the stadium about Joe and people taking a knee, and was it about the victims? It was all very sort of mixed and odd. And afterwards, Bo Pelini went up to the lectern and said, I don't understand why we played this game today. Some mm-hmm. things are just more important than football and keeping the Big Ten schedule. And that to me, I was like, thank you. Because if nothing else, like, let's forget about blame for a second. Let's take a step back and say the real victim here were these children. And that has to be, I think, the starting point of every discussion if there's going to be real healing and trying to connect some of the feelings in Happy Valley with some of the outsized rage-filled feelings that occur in the west of the country that just don't understand what's going on in Happy Valley and vice versa.
Sally, you want to weigh in on that?
Well, yes. One thing that I would point out, I mean, that those town hall meetings, there were certainly sentiments expressed there that just definitely seemed over the top and inappropriate. But I do think that one of the reasons why there was such alumni anger at the president, Rodney Erickson, over the Paterno firing was not just because Joe Paterno, you know, because their feelings are too strong for Joe Paterno or Penn State football, but because the firing of Paterno seemed just one more echo of incompetency at the top of the university.
Yeah.
You know, this sort of rush to, you know, scapegoat Paterno, the lack of due process, the lack of systemic, you know, some sort of reasonable systemic examination just seemed to be one more case in which the leadership at the top of the university just absolutely failed to do anything right.
Let me get, looks like Kim from Westchester to join us on Radio Times. And Kim, go ahead, you're on the air.
Hi there. I'm a family therapist. I teach personal safety to elementary school kids for an agency that deals with prevention. And my son walked on the team for Joe Paterno in 1997 and played for him in Sandusky while he was there. You know, I think to me the silver lining, if we have to look for one, which I like to do, is because of the stature of Penn State and the stature of Joe Paterno, the whole issue of child sexual abuse prevention will now get more attention globally, perhaps. And it's a shame it took something like this to get there, but there's a lot of denial in society about the problem. And even with the whole Catholic Church situation, that was so big and more impersonal, I think, because they had a person to tag this to with Paterno and Sandusky. It seemed closer to home, more real, more disturbing. And the victims, you know, we kept being reminded these are the real tragedy here. So that's my hope, that this will bring awareness into the, you know, the whole issue of child sexual abuse prevention.
Okay.
I also think...
Well, you know what, Kim, I'm sorry to jump in here only because we got a lot of people that want to join us, and you raise a point we haven't talked about, and I want to give our guests a chance to weigh in on that. And Sally, in your interview with Joe Paterno, it seems that he also hoped what Kim had hoped.
Well, he did. He and Sue Paterno both said, you know, we're trying to find some good, as she just put it, silver lining. That's not the word they used, but you know, they said if nothing else comes out of this, hopefully this has dragged the issue into the national consciousness, the state college consciousness, the state consciousness. You know, they both of them expressed that sentiment more than one time in my conversations with them.
Dave, any thoughts?
No, just that I think that has to be what comes out of this. I mean, because if it doesn't, then you really are talking about a great crime that happens just in vain.
Just picking up on something that Joe Paterno told Sally Jenkins, feeling that, you know, he didn't want to interfere and in a sense didn't want to throw his weight around. And yet, Dave, when we hear descriptions of Joe Paterno, it sounds as if he was perhaps the most influential person on the Penn State campus.
I mean, I think that would definitely be something that Sally would be more adept at speaking about the actuality of that than me. I do know that Joe Paterno would insist that anybody who thought that he was somehow the Wizard of Oz or the guy behind the curtain was grossly inflating his own importance. I mean, my study of it, and it's not an on-the-ground study. I didn't go to Penn State. I've never worked in Happy Valley. I've been there for games and for events, but I've never actually lived there for a long period of time. But my take on it is that there's a gap between Joe Paterno, the human being, and the actual day-to-day power he had, especially over the last 10 years or so, but a gap between that and how the sort of image of Joe Paterno was used at the highest level of the campus to portray a certain branding of the campus, whether it was for boosters, whether it was for people coming in from the outside to look at the campus, whether it was visiting dignitaries. And so there was a degree to which he was built up in a way that the individual on a day-to-day level was not, which makes to me, when I look at the actions and when I read the grand jury report of the people at the highest levels of power at Penn State, it looks like this exercise in brand protection, not protection of Joe Paterno, the individual, but brand protection. And when Joe Paterno, the individual, became toxic to that brand, he was worth nothing more than a 10 p.m. phone call.
Mm. Sally, one of the things that you write, and I'm not, I can't remember if you said this or if Joe Paterno said this, but that he stayed too long?
Oh, well, I wrote that. I mean, it's what I believe. I think that he probably should have retired sooner than he did, and I don't think he thought that. And I think that obviously there were people at the university who felt that because Graham Spanier tried to get him to retire. I think it was back in 2004 and failed. One of the things that complicated Paterno's standing on campus is that he was a tenured professor, and also he was a huge donor to the university. He'd given $4 million, which is why his name is on that library. And so I think that, you know, he had a lot of emotional support among the Board of Trustees. I think Joe Paterno, it's unclear to me what the nature of his power was, particularly in the last decade. I think it's entirely possible he was very much a figurehead and sort of emotional leader. I do know that Paterno and his family went out of their way to say, look, there were numerous cases where Joe may have disagreed with what the university leadership was doing and did not get his way. There was a baseball stadium built very near the football stadium that he violently objected to. If he'd had his way, it would have been way across campus. That was one example that people close to him pointed out to me and said, look, Joe didn't have the clout. People think he did. Otherwise, that stadium, that baseball stadium, would have been down the valley. You know, a $4 billion revenue-producing public research institution has a very complex leadership. Football, in the last decade, produced nice revenue. In some cases, I think the football budget was around 70, or the athletic department budget was around $70 million. But that's really a drop in the bucket compared to the government grants that Penn State was commanding. So I think the nature of Paterno's power at Penn State is a complicated topic and a murky topic. I'm not clear on it, and I don't think anybody can be until these investigations play out.
Let me get Marianne from Philadelphia to join us. Marianne, you're on Radio Times. Go ahead.
I just wanted to make a comment in particular regarding the feedback on the alumni meetings. I'm a Penn Stater from a huge Penn State family. And, you know, my family, my friends, we were absolutely devastated when this all came out. And devastated because it was just, you know, we were living this Happy Valley dream and this evil was happening. And we felt, I think the reaction of so many people like myself is complicated. I don't think that that's being captured in the media, but, you know, when they have a town hall meeting, you're going to get alumni that come there that have the most extreme viewpoints. You're not going to get the people like myself that feel conflicted, hurt, sad for the victims, just sad for what this means for the place that you love so much and people you felt held in such high regard. But there's a lot of people that think, you know, have really complicated emotions about this. And you know, I don't think Joe could have come out and coached that game. And that something had to happen, but we feel awfully about the way the firing was handled. Mm-hmm. But I don't think that you hear that when you're, it saddens me, this depiction of Penn State alumni, like these rabid, you know, people that are totally insensitive to these horrible crimes. I think that's just not a representative view.
Well, I appreciate the fact that you called into Radio Times, Marianne, and raised that point and talked about how conflicted you feel, because I think that really speaks to how a lot of people feel. Dave, you want to weigh in on that?
Just that I think that's been the great failure of the Board of Trustees and their public statements, and the new president, Erickson, is conveying that, because, I mean, everything I know as far as people I know from Penn State mirror what the last caller just said in terms of that panoply of emotions. And yet, of course, just like a congressional town hall meeting, I mean, who actually comes out to those? It will be a certain segment that self elects themselves to speak on these most extreme viewpoints. And I think there's been a real opportunity for Erickson to make that clear, to look at these town hall meetings with the cameras running, knowing this is going to go out to the nation, and say, look, it's complicated. And this is a very real human tragedy, and there are very real bureaucratic issues we're trying to untangle, and we love our school, and we're going to fight for it to be better and learn from it. Instead, you get this constant resuscitation of this word, which I hate this word, which is the word brand, and the Penn State brand, and how it's been affected, and it makes it all sound so bloodless, and it doesn't capture the fact that the very real alumni out there are hurting right now, and mm-hmm. they're the ones who need to be represented by the president, not either the extreme view of who shows up to the meetings or the Board of Trustee members concerned about the next round of grants and booster giving and where that's going to come from.
And Sally, we're almost out of time here. Why did Joe Paterno want you to interview him?
Well, he wanted to defend his record to somebody, and I think the Washington Post coverage, I think he felt had been a little more discerning than some newspapers. I think he wanted to talk to somebody independent who was not part of the State College community. A number of reasons, I think, and I'm just glad the Washington Post got the very critical, interview in which he put his version of events on record. We'll see how it holds up.
Indeed, and
but
we should.
Sally, can I just say something?
Yeah.
Sally also said something interesting in an interview I saw with her about her dad, who's a brilliant sports writer.
In fact, your dad, Sally Jenkins, had interviewed Joe Paterno early on in his career.
He had. My father, Dan Jenkins, was a sports writer at Sports Illustrated Magazine for 30 years, and back in 1968, he wrote a profile of a very young Joe Paterno who was trying to conduct a big-time football program with Ivy League values, and he profiled Paterno for Sports Illustrated Magazine. And so I think that, in some sense, Paterno maybe felt it was coming full circle to talk with me.
Well, as I said, I was ambivalent about doing the show, but I'm really glad that we did, and I'm glad that we had both of you on the show. Sally Jenkins, thanks so much.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Sports columnist for the Washington Post. And Dave Zirin, thank you very much as well.
My privilege. Thank you.
You're very welcome. And he's sports editor of The Nation magazine. We appreciate those phone calls to Radio Times. We could have kept going. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times, and you can weigh in on this particular issue. Send us an email. Also go on our Facebook page as well. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thank you for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times. We'll be right back.